Good evening, everybody. I'm Ann Temkin. I'm the Mary Jose and Henry Kravis Chief Curator of Painting and Sculpture and Curator of the Gabriel Orozco Exhibition. I want to welcome you all here tonight. We're thrilled to have people, dare that the snow isn't going to kind of be falling as we speak and trap them here. I think we're well in advance of that. And this is a long-awaited public conversation, not about Orozco's work in general necessarily, although I think it will very much touch on that, but about the incredible mobile matrix, the whale that is residing right now in the museum's atrium. And I have Pablo Elguera here from our museum's education department to explain to you how the evening will go, and I hope you all enjoy it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Anne. And thank you all for coming to tonight's discussion. This panel presented in conjunction with Gabriel Orozco's mid-career retrospective here at MoMA. As many of you might know already of Gabriel's work, I will still mention briefly a few things about his work and about his biography and specifically about his relationship historically with this museum, and that brings us to this conversation. Gabriel Orozco studied at the Escuela Nacional de Artes Plásticas and the University of Mexico and the Círculo de Bellas Artes in Madrid. Following his first exhibition in 1983, Orozco has had solo exhibitions at the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris in 1995 and 1998, the Serpentine Gallery in London in 2004, at the Museo del Palacio de Bellas Artes in 2006, as well as several traveling retrospectives around the world. This exhibition upstairs offers a comprehensive look at the work of Orozco of the last two decades, while at the same time celebrates an artist whose relationship with MoMA starts very much at the beginning of his international career. In 1993, MoMA presented Orozco's first museum exhibition in the United States, which was part of the museum's project series. In this early show, Orozco broke with the usual format of these type of exhibitions, which normally happen within the white cube space. Instead, for this project, he proposed a number of works that explored the interstitial spaces of the museum, and that, in his own words, were about site specificity, time specificity, interventions of space in everyday life, everyday objects. The project included seemingly simple but yet deeply meaningful gestures, such as working with the neighbors to play oranges outside the windows of 54th Street that faces the museum, or placing a hammock at the museum garden, sculpture garden, as well as placing a ball of vulcanized rubber at the bottom of the museum's escalators. Ever since that time, Gabriel Orozco's work has reflected and questioned the very notion of site specificity and the tension between the object and the space that it occupies. This tension is also exemplified if you visit the galleries on the first object that one sees entering the exhibition upstairs, a white cardboard shoebox, which was first exhibited by the artist at the Venice Biennial in 1993. In its current context, the white box becomes, let's say, a white box within a white box of the galleries. And in the words of Gabriel in conversation, it was a way to symbolically cleanse the audience from any other previous experiences at the museum to see the show. Now, the piece that gives the title to tonight's presentation, Mobile Matrix, exemplifies his work with the viewer's expectations and with the complexities of space. It was created for the National Library José Vasconcelos in Mexico City, which is over here. It consists in an immense skeleton of a whale whose structure bears the drawings of various concentric circles. In the words of Benjamin Buchlaw, this piece is one in which the spectator is confronted on the dimension of death and the disappearance of the natural, but also with a self-reflective statement on modernist ideals through sculpture. He writes, quote, "Teaching the spectator how texture and structure, mass and gravity, weight and matter all interrelate not only to define the body of a sculpture, but also to constitute a self-conscious, perceiving, phenomenological subject in the spectatorial act." The making of Mobile Matrix is a fascinating story that started in the beaches of Baja California and continues through its momentous arrival here at MoMA and its presence here. We are lucky to have with us Marco Barrera Basols, a key collaborator of Gabriel, who helped engineer the process by which the whale was transformed into what it is today. And he's here to give us a perspective, his perspective on that work. Marco Barrera Basols is a Mexico City-based independent curator and exhibition designer. He has been deputy director of the Museum of Popular Cultures in Mexico City and director of the Museum of Natural History there as well. He has designed over 200 exhibitions and museum projects ranging from contemporary art to natural history, anthropology, and science, such as the Museum of Mexican History in Monterrey, the Museum of Northern Cultures in Paquimé, Chihuahua, and currently working in partnership with the museum design firm Museográfica. We felt that Mobile Matrix, or the whale, as we commonly call it now, because now at MoMA has become sort of family, was a fascinating topic from where to start a retrospective discussion. That is, to depart from this work to address what has been perennial concerns in Orozco's works, such as creating dialectics of objects in space, questioning permanence, placement, and the physical presence of the object. For this, we are grateful that we have Molly Nesbitt, a noted historian and writer who has also been an interlocutor of Gabriel for many years and who has reflected most eloquently on his work. So we're very happy, Molly. Molly is a professor of art history at Vassar College and a contributing editor for Art Forum. Her books include Ajet's Seven Albums from Yale University Press in 92 and Their Common Sense from Black Dog Press in 2000. Midnight, The Tempest Essays, a collection of her essays on contemporary art, will be published by Periscope Press. Since 2002, together with Hans-Ulrich Obrist and Rick Ritz-Trivania, she has been organizing Utopia Station, an ongoing book, exhibition, seminar, website, and street project. The format tonight will be that Marco and Molly will present those short presentations, starting with Molly, on Gabriel's work. And we will follow with a conversation with Gabriel, followed hopefully with your questions and comments, which we will welcome. Molly, thank you.
Thank you, Pablo. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Gabriel. Thank you, Marco. It's nice to be here. I have a brief, which was and remains site specificity. So I'll begin there. We're on our way to the whale, but the whale is not really my topic. So I'll take you to the whale, and then it's Marco's turn. It's a relay. Ah, good. Now, it's my role to set a context for the discussion of the Mobile Matrix, and I'm here then to mark the root of a man's art in time. But I think as we do this, we have to ask the question, is one object necessarily more important along this route than another object? Now, site specificity, the way in which a sculpture exists in a particular time and space only, is a relatively recent term. In practice, this way in which a sculpture can exist in a particular time and space only has been fragile. You can think of Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty with its, you know, battle, internal battle with the lake. You can think of Gordon Matta-Clark's Arc de Triomphe for the workers in Sesto San Giovanni, which exists as a drawing for a cut that he did on this photograph of the building where he never made it in 1975. Typically, one thinks of Richard Serra's Tilted Arc, which was put up in 1980. Matta-Clark's work, as I said, was never built. Serra's was forcibly removed. But neither was meant to exist in and of itself alone. Site specificity is a critic's code, really, for the relation of sculpture to the pulse of history. Perhaps we've needed the term because in modern times the relation to histories has been made for us mainly not by sculptures, but by images. First, by paintings like David's Oath of the Horatii. I'm an art historian, so we do a little of this. And this marks really the beginning of it all. The way in which an image carries history for us. But the duties of the history painting for the state would pass for a complex of reasons, some of which involve the untrustworthiness and seditiousness of paintings. The duties would pass to the new news media in the early 20th century, specifically to the picture magazines like Life, which put the history photograph forward, embedded, though, on the page. Robert Capa's image of a Spanish soldier's death is made to coexist. The picture of history is one of relations to captions, to articles, to the business of hair health, so that the picture of history becomes increasingly fragile, too. History painting survived better in Mexico. We have the Mexican muralist Diego Rivera to thank for the frescoes, permanent, not mobile, that he painted at the Detroit Institute of Arts in 1932, where, in the wake of the River Rouge plant's bloody strikes, Edsel Ford commissioned a cycle showing the plant integrated into the great cycles of life. The figures are life size. It is a human history we see that finds its center in the coordinated labor of the worker. 60 years later, Gabriel Orozco's early work takes its time and place seriously. It enters time and place, activating a space and leaving it, he would say. Alternately, he would say he is, quote, working in reality. Reality being another word for history, we proceed. In 1992, he made this work in plasticine. Jimmy Durham had made him a big present. It was a work that was a ball. He called it Yielding Stone. It possessed human scale, too. It was not very big, but instead heavy, equivalent to Orozco's own body weight. It was meant to exist in time and space, but informally. There is no single specific site. You see here a street in the Mexican city of Monterrey, right? Monterrey? Gabriel? Monterrey? This was a stone meant to move. And because plasticine never hardens, its surface is soft and absorbs the dust of the street, the poke of a finger, the pressure of the outside. The mobility of the object, the mobility of its surface, performs a kind of miracle of touch. It seems pre-modern. But we are left with a confusion between the stone's surface and this image of its surface. In other words, we have come to know the yielding stone as much through its photograph, which is also a work. The photograph leaves the space of the background loose. It doesn't try to organize the stone into a pictorial composition. The picture is only a container, Orozco would say, something like a truck or a box. Containers can be empty. Containers can themselves be sculptures, like the shoebox he sent to the Venice Biennale in 1993, or the temporary sculpture he made that same year down in Lower Manhattan, which he called an island and an island. And the island, of course, is swept away. Now, with these works, Orozco himself entered history, art history, visibly. But for all the ways in which this work has been touched, human presence is only implied by the objects he makes. It is not shown. In this work, there are spaces for experience and experiment. And this is the point I'd like to make most of all, they ask for different ways of seeing them. It's really the question of sight specificity that I'd like to raise. Now, we have inherited our ways of seeing. In the United States, there are those we learn and those that are, so to speak, in the drinking water. The way of seeing experience and experiment is, first and foremost, pragmatic. Pragmatism, I'm not using it generally, we're about to get a little technical, but it's technical and I think beautiful. Pragmatism comes with its specificity too. And it's worth a detour because we'll see more clearly if we activate our pragmatism on the way to the whales. Now, the philosopher William James put pragmatism forward in a university lecture at Berkeley in 1898, explaining that, quote, the effective meaning of any philosophic proposition can always be brought down to some particular consequence in our future practical experience, whether active or passive. The point lying rather in the fact that the experience must be particular rather than the fact that it must be active. That's all William James. You could think of the experience of the yielding stone. In other words, this particularity is known and will come to mean something because of an effect that will take place later, something done perhaps, or something seen or heard or touched. Most important is its specificity, the close focus. Although James does not say so exactly, there is a relation to a human scale. None of it, however, stays small. James credited his friend Charles Sanders Peirce with the concept, pragmatism, although he himself was extending it. And elsewhere, he would liken this theory, to an instrument, not an answer, and see the pragmatist to have the attitude that looks away from first things, principles, categories, and supposed necessities, and instead trains his mind on the last things, the fruits, the consequences, the facts. We could supply any number of examples, green strawberries, wars of religion, the temperature of the air at dawn, but pragmatists brought their own cast of catalysts. Thought would both appear and act as they moved it, relatively, into the details of the world they hoped to know better. Now, Peirce had drafted the first formulations of pragmatism in the 1870s. There was a pair of articles, The Fixation of Belief and How to Make Ideas Clear. Nothing new, he'd remarked there, can ever be learned by analyzing definitions. Dry sentences like that one set the new tone. It's an American tone. Ideas which achieve their clarity by virtue of producing habits of action, he explained, these being effects, sensed and having practical bearing. He opened matters out into the 19th century's own contribution to the experimental sciences. He tested his ideas by posing precisely physical problems for logic. Now, Peirce's examples still cut sharp. They still shine. Sometimes they come with a grin, sometimes they fall away. Duchamp liked them. He set the hard against the soft, had diamonds disappear untouched into cotton. He brought forward the doubts besetting a mind waiting for a train. He saw reality ultimately to be independent of an individual person's thoughts. He broke pace to quote an entire stanza from Thomas Gray's poem, Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard. He had breadth. Logic, scientific advance, and art would not be merged by this pragmatism into a new compound. Rather, each contributed to reveal different aspects of life, even those that man might never see. Now, after William James's lectures, and there were many, a momentum built internationally for this pragmatism coming from America. Borges would not be immune. Peirce, too, refined his sense of what a pragmatist could do. He wanted the pragmatist to ask the largest possible questions about the place of all of this and us in time. Some of this is present in statements like, quote, the rational meaning of every proposition lies in the future, or you need not fear to compromise your darling theory by looking out at its windows. He wanted the pragmatist to look beyond the windows, to weigh the world for the future of man. The future came quickly. Peirce died in 1914. James had already died in 1910. But by then, John Dewey had already done much to secure the international momentum of these ideas and extend them in other directions. Dewey stood beyond the windows. He put pragmatism together with the social reform movements. He gave this thinking other kinds of practical traction. Dewey was becoming the great American philosopher of democratic education. He wrote of living forward. In early 1917, while most of Europe had gone to war and the United States waited, he wrote an essay in which he gave the questions a place of sorts to stand. Knowledge, he stated, kind of inhospitably, is viewing from the outside. Knowledge is viewing from the outside. He made no distinction between the knower and the world. It is between the different ways of being in and of the movement of things, he said, between a brute physical way and a purposive, intelligent way. A decade later, at the end of his book, Experience in Nature, Dewey gave art a key role to play in the confrontation of all the difficulty. It would be both tool and practice in the service of the large experiment. It had a use. It was an education to perception, new modes of perception, a means to a future sight. For Dewey, modern art was neither an alien nor an abstraction. It, too, had the capacity to act as a catalyst. In 1934, he published Art as Experience, the book that made these ideas clear. It was dedicated to William James. In its preface, he thanked the young art historian Meyer Shapiro for his help. Meyer Shapiro had been his student. Shapiro's early work takes pragmatism forward. But this pragmatism did not structure our public theories of modern art, like site specificity. It's now three quarters of a century later, and we walk in their future. But this revived pragmatism does not in and of itself explain or become a recipe for what follows. There is no recipe. The strawberries remain green. The wars of religion are ongoing. The air at dawn is freezing. Conclusions become provisions. The future hasn't eased. The work of art becomes a catalyst. Gabriel Orozco produced casts of catalysts, too. They use logic along with everything else, but they do not themselves become a logic. They are all of them full of thinking that could be named, but we must move on. Destabilizing the view in order to open up matters, to deposit us outside the things of the world, led Gabriel Orozco in the mid-1990s to Circles, the light boxes for Korea's biennial at Gwangju in 1995 would be one of the early places where one could see these big in public. It would lead him to kites. It would lead him to computer drawings that were laid over photographs, webs of pattern that themselves become woven surfaces, dense, often handmade, like the kites, the black kites, drawn in pencil in 1997 over the skull. They do not form a rule. The surfaces are various, impermanent, sometimes stable, usually still keeping human scale, exhibiting their mobility extravagantly, but quietly, as if they're on their way to something else, to a future one does not see yet. And it keeps going. Knowing is viewing from the outside. After 2003, roughly, there is another general direction we should talk about. Because Gabriel Orozco has been pulling back from these surfaces to make a surface or kind of surface that closes tight like a drum undrummed. The painting itself of these works, like the Samurai Tree series in 2005, is delegated to assistants. It's not marked physically, the surface, by the artist's touch. It takes greater and great distance from sight It seems to take a long view onto what we see. Is it the long view we get when we ask about history? I don't know. But the long view expands the scale of the work enormously. The samurai trees come in series, and it's part of the expansion that brings us to the whale. On the surface of the whale, mobile matrix, which you see upstairs, it too is impersonal in the sense that it's executed by others' hands and lots of pencils. But it exists not only in relation to the library space for which it was made, but it exists with its own negative, a negative whale, you could say, a twin, made the same year for the White Cube Gallery in London, a twin called the Dark Wave. Matrix and wave, mobile and dark, they're not exactly identical, and others will explain. But one being the positive of the other or the negative of the other, we're brought back, if we look at them together, to this question of surfaces again, to the surface of inversion, where one surface turns inside out. It's something like a photographic condition, let's say. It's something unstable. The whales have swallowed the characteristics of the image. We're not sure just what it is objectively now that we see and from what distance. But the surface of the work has been emancipated. It opens up again to something outside itself. It opens up again to the eye. And that's what makes the elephant's foot so compelling. For it, too, opens the problem of the surface up again differently now and swallows up a swarm of little glass eyes, so that they put man's relation to nature forward again, so that we can, from the outside, peer in and try to see something more, maybe like pragmatists. History, too, stands outside viewing. History, Foucault said somewhere, is not a meaning. Then what is it? We might answer. History is the thing we call death. And history is the thing we call life. History is in our eyes. We see with it, just as we see things the best we can. Call it pragmatism's second wind. And there I stop.
Okay. I would like to thank MoMA, especially Laura Bayless and Pablo Elguera, for inviting me to participate in this discussion. Gabriel and the Whale, working as an exhibition designer, curator, and producer in a dialogue between natural sciences and art. In addition to our friendship and work together, always an adventure, it was a pleasant surprise for me when I realized that it may have been our similar educational upbringing in active school in Mexico City that allowed Gabriel and me to share two essential aspects in the projects that we have carried out. His capacity to transform any object into work of art always fascinated me, and this comes from his fine-toned, peculiar sort of vision. So, it does not come as a shock to me that the photographs that we have taken on our countless travels together are often so similar in both the subject matter and the framing of the subject. The second aspect has to do with the need to collect objects that we find on the street or in the desert or even in the garbage bin. We are, if you will, collectorists, because we are moved to collect these objects, even despite the objects themselves. As a son of a biologist, I learned to appreciate what others did not see or even bother to look at, whether it was insects, rodents, or birds. I also learned to build up the necessary patience, stealth, and silence for watching a turtle rise for the surface of a reservoir to take a breath, or to catch a sudden movement or a sound of a snake, a deer, or a jaguar, but also to find beauty in a rock, a shell or a prehispanic base, the fog or the sky. With my parents, I discover my country's oceans, jungles and deserts, the rainforests and the highest mountain peaks. And I also discover its village and people and learn to appreciate the festive culinary diversity. Traveling with Gabriel has allowed to me to recapture those moments and to relive those instincts while sharpening my sense again and playing with the focusing of my gaze. Another aspect that I believe I share with him has to do with my work in museums and my interest in the relationship between art as a language and its happy intersection with the natural sciences as a discipline and as a vision of the world. All of this has allowed me, through our work together, to deepen our friendship whilst merging together points of interest, allowed to me to state that its merging has been fortunate and that it does not appear too often in a lifetime. Working with Gabriel, the exhibition designer as a curator and facilitator. As a museum and exhibition designer, I have developed projects in Mexico, the US, Canada, Europe, Asia, and South America. For the last 28 years, I have defended my profession as a museographer in the midst of an erupting curator fashion era. As in other countries, exhibition designers in Mexico are seen simply as the technical assistants of curators. I hold that museographers not only have the intellectual tools to do the work of a curator, but that they are also able to design comprehensive exhibitions with considerations to the audience and exhibition conditions while respecting the artist's vision. Yet, with all of this experience, my work with Gabriel has demanded more skill and attention from me than any other. Perhaps a statement that best defines the work I have carried out with Gabriel was one by Per Anderson, a Belarusian lithographer and printer, told me what being a lithographer means to him. This is to facilitate the work of the artist by preparing the stone, the ink, and the drawing instruments, even producing personally the paper and the press, to accompanying them in their process until the print has no rival. That is being a facilitator. How we found and designed Mobile Matrix. When we rescued the gray whale in Sand Island, Baja California, we rescued something like 170 bone puzzles that we had to organize and assemble, with many options on how to accomplish this. To respond to this challenge, Gabriel and I organized a team of advisors, technicians, and artists. Four scientists were involved in the project in varying degrees. One of them, a biologist, was responsible for preparing the voyage for the incredible exploration of Guerrero Negro, Baja California. A physical anthropologist, technician, and paleontologist advised us on the anatomy and osteological treatment. Pierre-Yves Gagnier, another paleontologist and director of collections at the Natural History Museum in Paris at that time, sent us very helpful information. In the end, we decided to assemble Mobile Matrix the same way that all museums of natural history did, and follow the method of aerial suspension of whale skeletons that we had seen exhibited at the Gallery of Evolution in Paris. Perhaps the greatest difference between those hanging whale skeletons and Mobile Matrix is that the steel structure designed to piece the skeleton together is cleaner. No screws were fixed to any bones. Another difference between Mobile Matrix and the other skeletons that we saw on exhibit in newer museums of natural history is that their structures function as an imitation of the cartilage that joins the bones of the spinal column and flippers or hands, and we decided to leave these spaces open to allow the steel structure to remain visible. It is important to clarify that all these decisions were made based on aesthetic criteria, and this would not have been possible without the knowledge of all these experts. The same can be said for all the technicians, craftsmen, and artists who were part of the team and who took over the production of the steel structure under the guidance of a terrific architect and an engineer who adapted our design, or those who reproduced the bones that we needed, or the artist who assists Gabriel with the drawings. Final decisions were always taken by Gabriel, and in that sense, my job was to provide different options so he could decide with help of others. Mobile Matrix is a conjunction of 40 people working for 4 months using 6,000 graphite leads in the drawing process, providing all of the knowledge required for a project that weighs more than a ton and that initially hung from the ceiling of the Vasconcelos Library in Mexico City, as well as the preparation to bring it here only 2 months ago. All of this brings to mind the phone call I received from Gabriel, asking me if I knew someone who could find him a well skeleton and someone else who would be in charge for assembling it. And I said, just both, because I'm also crazy. This also explains why I'm here, sharing these ideas today, and also why I decided to write a special book with all these minor details. It's called Mobile Matrix Installation Manual. All corners are a center, or a left for Gabriel. It is understood that one of the ways that an artist deals with the flow of modernity is through a reinterpretation of the process, the impression, and the rhythm or sequence in the act of perceiving and interpreting the vision again. In this sense, in the samurai tree, Gabriel disturbs the model of the reticle on a bidimensional plane and ventures to query space in more dimensions, including the temporal of the process itself. Gabriel states Yves Saint Lambois in a catalogue of Gabriel's retrospective exhibition at the Museum of Bellas Artes in Mexico in 2006, nullifies the grid and decentralized the motive and performative gesture on the basis that all corners are a center, or at least could be very well be one. I know that Gabriel has been interested in Borges, here clear, Science University. I believe he worked with some of these implications in Mobile Matrix and later in Dark Wave too. After months of designing and mounting the cetacean, I'm not entirely sure if he will agree with me on this, but I will seem that he also worked in a decentralized way. This decentralization was carried out with an operation of or artistic model that combines the idea of craft with handcrafted aspects, even semi-industrial or post-industrial aspects. Gabriel is involved in a type of system world that also allows him to work on several projects simultaneously and distance himself from the mechanist view of the use of space and work. At the same time, by putting the accent on both the conceptual and philosophical gesture, Gabriel goes a step beyond and makes a contribution. He defines a different methodology. Gabriel's methodology manages to remove itself of traditional habits and leans toward a form that seems to flow together with the notion of what is alive, a logos from where we evolve. He develops his work with an acute sense of his surroundings as well as from in the matrix of his cultural knowledge. I have the impression that his body of work proceeds not on the basis of the usual concept where one attempts to reach in each work a type of climax or crowning creation, but rather that it unfolds along as feeling or concept, a sliding intuition or drift. In the world of biology, I think that it's common error to consider ourselves outside of it, Once a high degree of complexity is reached by an organic system, its behavior with regard to its functioning develops with its own balanced impulse. It begins and acquires inertia gradually, optimizing its function with the environment. Gabriel reveals an inclination to swiftly and eloquently enter or leave his activity whilst leaving a pleasant sensation of an effortless creativity and what appears to be a punctual concentration. Sorry. In this regard, Gabriel is a tinkerer or juggler of what is alive, a traveler who enjoys experimenting with new forms of poetry and trying out innovative ideas. It is not surprised, then, that he can develop such subtle and diverse work in different places. At the same time, this has caused his volume of work to grow enormously, to the point of giving the impression that his work is much more than the sum of its parts. I mention this because I feel that his perspective complements, even if it's from the perspective of the natural science and my own, Yves Alain Bois' points of view when he speaks of an organic model in Gabriel's work programmed mathematically. The following quote by Gabriel appears in the catalog that I mentioned previously and concerns his sculptural and pictorial work, the center and the centralization. I believe that the sculptural notion that is present in all my work is that of beginning in the center and growing from it. In Mobile Matrix, Gabriel saw not one, but many centers. That center, said Gabriel, is the spinal column of the body, is the point of gravity that connects the body with the earth. Painters work with the idea of the vanishing point, with something flat and abstract that will be in front of the spectator. A sculptural mentality, on the other hand, relates to the ground and moves upward. When you think in spherical terms, you must combine the vanishing point and the gravity point. That is why Mobile Matrix lies floating, demonstrating that gravity in the universe does its work. Gabriel concludes, this also generates movement of orbits or centrifugal, a type of turbulence, which perhaps explains why the sphere or the circle is the best form for me to show the vanishing and gravity points. The page in Gabriel's notebook where he listed the possible names for Mobile Matrix appears photographed in the MoMA catalog. The names include Turbulencia Ósea, Bony Turbulence, and Anillos Cetáceos, something like cetacean strings, and other ones. If we transfer this reflection to Dark Wave, another project where he develops a cetacean in alternate drawing version, the body being is actually a replica of the original skeleton of a rorqual whale, he offers us a deeper meaning. The three-dimensionality, the volume of the empty skeleton which works as a container or canvas, I insist, makes the graphite drawing, its centers and centrifugal orbits or turbulences, another reference or place from where to start. Seeing any of those whales is to see something move on itself. This allows to me to understand the sculptural notion of its painting and his constant interest in explaining why, as he mentions in the quote, the sphere or the circle is the best from him to show the vanishing and gravity points. Naturalis Codex. In many ways, when a work is conceived, carried out, or contemplated, it is an open work, an open book. To have accompanied the different facets of Mobile Matrix achievement and seen it mounted here in the atrium of the MoMA fills me with joy and makes me reflect on countless things, including its morphology expanding from the center in concentric rings like ripples of water, the element that the cetacean inhabited, or sound traveling through oceans distributing itself through a spherical air that picks up sounds, options, and traces of terrestrial meaning. Language is not just a tool, I mean to an end. We are somehow made by language and not other way around. And this attitude represents in itself a new level of complexity. In the context of this exhibition, I believe that while Marcel Duchamp may have already broken the limits of interpretation by modifying the sense of an object in his introduction of ready-made, for me, the whale, now as a work of art like Mobile Matrix, also provides an opportunity for establishing new paradigms. Moving away gradually from the vision of a world defined by a mechanical view of Cartesian philosophy and his perception of time, the whale brings to the mind the notion that time in nature is different, since everything in nature implies time. Transformation and duration are essentially two ways it manifests itself. This work represents for me not only the possibility of perceiving in a variety of interdisciplinary ways, the same act of perceiving and it metabolizing the experience is manifested as a dynamic process where the language of aesthetics, philosophy, and in my case, the natural science conjugate. Rupert Sheldrake, scientist and science theoretician, better known for his ideas on morphic resonance, who also opposes the mechanist view of the natural sciences, sees the world as an animated dominion where species coexist, accumulating memories. These may be experiences, skills, or concrete aspects in the morphology of beings. He sees evolution as an accumulation of life knowledge. He formulated this in his well-known theory of morphogenetic fields. In the context of art as a field of knowledge, understanding it one of its greatest reference points, the MoMA, on the day we installed it, my Mobile Matrix in the atrium, Gabriel said to me, while admiring its spaces, more or less the following: in this museum alone, a greater part of the knowledge of the world is contained and synthesized. I agree, and I see this piece as a new word in the grammar of art, and curiously, the presence alone of this object, the unlikelihood that a wave would have deposited the remains of this body on the steps of the museum, as well as the fact that I was the genius of an artist that gave it continuity, makes me think that we are journeying from a competitive society to a more compassionate and obliging one, and that we are on the way to creating new tools for navigating through a reality of broader dimensions. This experience also leads me to think that perception is part of an evolutive faculty, and that cooperation in itself is in itself the same principle as evolution. As for me, and this is the last thought, I would like to thank the whale, which, with the testimony of its body that would otherwise have become sand, participated with its presence, body, and soul as a biological core of this artistic project. Thank you.
The whale is a panelist as well. Thank you, both of you, for your wonderful presentations and your passionate presentations, indeed. And hopefully we'll be able to meet somewhere around these ideas. The first one that still strikes me from what you mentioned was the quote by Dewey, knowledge is viewing from the outside. And Gabrielle, I remember the ones you said that you made art because you wanted to understand why we make objects. And I'm wondering if that thing that Molly said about stepping outside resonates, if it's about we make objects to understand them from the outside, if it has to do with stepping outside of the object. How does that resonate with you?
Thank you. Well, thank you. First, hello. Thank you very much. Well, that was very nice. Thank you, Marco and Molly. Thank you. I think probably what I try is always to step in, try to get inside an object and then go out and in and out. It's even, I guess, the project at MoMA when I put the oranges, and I ask to put the oranges, has to do with the inside, the outside, the private, the public, the interior and the exterior of a body or a box or a sculpture. For me, to make what we call sculpture is it has to do with starting from the interior or the center and then building up some kind of structure that can be air or can be something like filaments or something that builds up and then becomes an object. So I think the whole relationship with something has to do with that, with an interaction that starts from some kind of center in time, in space, that grows and then develops into a relationship. So I think tridimensionality or the idea of a sphere has to do with that dialectical movement between the inside and the outside, the center and the surface. It's very important to step out to see what you're doing. And it's very important to step out of yourself to see who you are, if you can. It's very important to go out of your country to see how it is from the outside. So I think it's important, yes, to step out of things and be somehow distant. And maybe thinking in this the idea of the mechanical, the sense that it's not just like the intimacy of the relationship that brings some truth. It's very important to have the intimacy of the experience with something, but also in art, it's very important that experience of just letting go or the things to happen without the artist being all the time there. I think it's important this mechanicity in terms of generating organisms that are just growing, somehow independent of the wish and the preconceptions that we establish. So things grow, and we have to provoke that. So that's why the mechanical is important, to establish some rules and some ideas, but then that other people can do them. So,
Speaking of stepping outside and seeing things from the outside, well, the whale stepped outside, and now it's in a different space. And I wonder how you read it now. How has the whale changed from its original context? Is it a different piece now? Is it? Do you perceive it? This is both for. I don't know if you saw it in the original context.
I never saw it in the library, so which I think is important to its genesis, right?
I'm just curious about the new context.
First, I always try that any site-specific project, I try to make it travel, because I think that there are two things. One is site specificity, and the other one, that probably is the one that I'm most interested in, is time specificity. So I think that obviously you cannot separate them, but somehow they are two words. Time and space, they are somehow different things, although they are together. So how you decide or you make a work in time, in a time moment that you decide to do this and that, but then it's obviously a very particular space, a local situation. So the whale was conceived for this building in Mexico, and in fact was not planned to travel, never. That's why I make Dark Wave. Dark Wave was for me a kind of replica, and that's why I make it negative. And I try to do it with a different type of whale, so it will be interesting for me to try a different shape. But this is a cast, it's not a real whale, because as you know, the real bones of a whale cannot travel, they are protected. unless you have such a powerful institution as MoMA, so they make all the permits happen. And probably they paid with cash to some people to bring it here. But they did a lot of work to bring it here because it's a protected species. So I honestly thought that we'll never travel. In fact, the other specificity on this project is that it will never happen if it was not commissioned by the government, because the whale is a protected species that you cannot buy a whale. You cannot. There is no market for this. So the only way was that it was always belongs all the time to Mexico, to the government. It's a protected place. So then it was like the only thing we did was just to remove it from one protected place to another protected place, and with a little bit of our decoration in the middle. But basically, they can erase it if they don't like it. I mean, it's nothing like. That's why I did it in pencil, actually, because. So it's just a small intervention, but basically, it belongs to the Mexican people. And I just charge for my honorariums, and I give a little bit of it a very little to Marco. So, but anyway, that's why I was somehow when I got this idea for the building, because the building I was very enthusiastic about the building. I have this image, and then I said, "Let's do it." Marco helped me. Then all was very specific in that sense. That belongs. I mean, it really comes from a very specific situation. And the dark wave after was somehow to have a kind of replica in negative that could travel, because the other dark wave, the one made in London, is a cast. So it's artificial. It's a different process. Both, I have to say, both I made the drawing. It's not that I feel every line, but as you could see in the photographs, I was there making the drawing with a bit campus and circles, and we were working together. So there was, of course, some assistance of Marco and many people making the drawing, but I think that at least the prototype of the origin of the idea is made by the one who has the idea, obviously. So but then the mechanical is just part of the process to finish the work. But I just that was the. What was the question?
What is a whale different now from before?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I have a little question. But there are actually two questions. One is, when you were working on the whale and you know, working out your circles and the gravity and so on, were you thinking about water and the sea as the space around it? And did that affect the way you imagined it? And the second question is, where is Black Kites in the prehistory of the whale? Is it anywhere or not?
Yeah, well, first question, yes. I think if you see like the photograph of the from roof to roof or the bicycle wheels on the extension of reflection, mm-hmm. the photograph of the wheels on water, I think that the this idea of, you know, waves, and of course in water, not just in water in general, but in water has been all my work before. And but also just the structure of such an animal is made to be in water, and probably the drawing was a way of exploring that anatomy, and obviously the anatomy is related with water and movement in that sense. So I think it's all just getting involved with a very sophisticated structure.
Did you want to invoke the water, though, or not?
Well, you know, sound also, not just water, but uh-huh. sound. The idea of wave. I mean, the other one is called dark wave. I guess the idea of it's just that the body in general is not just what it is containing the body. I think the body is always related to whatever happens around. We are moving. We are generating waves. Even if we don't see them, but there, everything we do has an implication in the immediate environment. And I think that a lot of the photograph work, or a lot of my photography talks about that, like gestures of the clay or the little interventions in reality, they have to do with that, the implication of a body in movement. And those are somehow waves, and even turbulence, this word that I use a lot in a lot of my work, the idea of turbulence is when a body is passing through water, it generates turbulence, and turbulence is a moment of a vacuum, or vacuum generates turbulence. So the idea of the void is also important in terms of movement, displacement generates a void, an immediate void that generates turbulence. So I think the shoebox has to do with that, too. I think the shoebox generates waves around. It's a funny thing because it's a square and it's cardboard and it's not alive.
You should tell the story about when it was first displayed because it's a good story.
You think so?
I do.
Well, I displayed in the Venice Biennial in a small booth they give to the young artists when we arrive, and it's all like a long corridor, and I decided to show this open shoebox in the small space we all have, but instead of having work or something, I wanted to kind of make an appropriation of the space using a very simple gesture. So, and it was read like that. At the beginning, was a kind of joke, and or people in fact didn't know it was an art or anything. Before the opening, it was kicked many times, clean out many times. I have to buy extra shoeboxes, put it in the bag, so I have to replace at least 5 times before the opening. And then during the opening, people were throwing coins, like giving me some money. Poor Mexican artist.
But who did you share with? Because it's a shared space, right?
No, not shared. I was like, well, that was another story of... Yeah. But anyway, going back to the black guys as the prehistory, I think that, probably, of course the black guys is like the grandfather of the mobile matrix. But it's the difference is that with the head, I wanted to overimpose or collapse the grid or a bidimensional structure like the grid or the checkerboard into a very complicated tri-dimensional organic object. But this is more like an imposition. I think somehow the fact that it's a grid or rectilinear grid imposed into a very organic thing, it makes it more something that has to do perhaps with this collapse between language and organism, or between reality and knowledge, or between or a structure of how we believe things are and how they really are. So it's like the kind of the grid will represent this structure that we have create through our culture and through language, and then something as an organism, natural or something, and put together these two things. And that is what generates the knowledge, I think. At the end, is this collapse between the two. I think in the Matrix Mobile is different. It's not, the whale is not human. So I guess my approach to that body was different. So, but it, yeah, they have to do. I mean, it's graphite and bone, right?
It seems.
You wanted to say something, by the way?
Yeah. If I need to say something, I think that mobile matrix grow up here.
It grew up here?
Yeah. I don't know why. It's not a natural thing. It's a space, and it's something in the surrounding that grow up the piece, and I don't know why.
Well, I think that, as you could see in the photographs, the context in the library is very busy. You have all these bookshelves floating, and it's very noisy. It was made for that. But then it was, and for me too, was nice to see it here in a more, empty space around and more neutral space, although massive, also difficult, very difficult, the atrium. But I think it was an interesting pleasure to see the detail of the drawing against a white background and see how it moves, and it becomes more an independent mobile that then when you walk around starts to move and you don't have distractions so much in the outside. So I think that somehow is interesting. Like in theory, is what a museum does. And it's very funny. The idea of the modern museum is that it's like a neutral space or a box, so you can contemplate an object with more detail or something. We know that it's not just like that, right? It's much more complicated than that. But in this case, to have it momentarily here was interesting as a kind of laboratory thing. You take an animal and you put it somehow in the place so you can look at it carefully. And I think the drawing and the whole thing works nicely. And I think, going back to that, it's interesting when a site-specific object, and in my case I tried to do that with some of them, like the shoebox, the yogurt cups, to bring them back in time and to a different situation is a way to test them and also to see how different we are and how it's not just how different the object is, because maybe it's the same, but how different the museum is, how different we are. That's why I couldn't bring the oranges, just because, some people was asking why you don't do the oranges again. But, first is winter. Second,
it's the season for oranges, Gabriel.
First is winter, so you cannot see outside. Second, they are selling the buildings in front, so real estate market is still hot. They're empty, all this. There are many reasons why you don't do an orange piece, But, no, really, it's true. It's that much into details when you have to make a new work or bring back an old work in time and space. You have to really see the new site-specific situation and the weather and anything.
I have a question about, the whales and then the other objects. And, it seems that in some cases your objects are very, very specific. It's the actual skeleton of a whale versus a yogurt cap or a shoebox. To what extent is it important to you to actually have the actual original object from an exhibition, let's say the original shoebox, as opposed to the one that you might find? I mean, it seems, in terms of the whale, it seems to be very specific. But is it always? I mean, are you attached to objects that way?
No. No, I'm not. I think it's not relevant that they are the original yogurt cups. I think they have to be kind of the same type of yogurt cups. Like, they have to have some resemblance. The shoebox also is not the original. The whale is the original, but the dark wave is not the original because it's a cast. I don't know. It's not so important. I think it's important that there is some information in the object that talks about the time it was made, of course. I mean, maybe to take another yogurt cup of, let's say, now, which is, by the way, there is impossible to find the same yogurt cups now. So there is something specific about that already that I will try not to change. And so we have to find the same. But it's not about the fetishization of this particular object. It's more about the information that is contained in the object that we need to conserve somehow. It's like, I don't know, maybe if cardboard ceases to exist and in 200 years, I don't think it will be nice to show a shoebox made out of plastic, as an example, very stupid example. But I think there are some things about the way it's made, something that has to be somehow kept intact, or, but it doesn't matter that it's exactly the same, the original. I don't think so.
Okay, but meanwhile, sort of putting the whale forward, and you begged all the questions about solidarity with the whales, saving the whales. I mean, is the whale in some way attached to a cause that you're trying to invoke, if not, actually present or represent?
Well, it's the same as you can, you can attach to the La Dehes, the Citroën, all the French patrimony, cultural history. Mm-hmm. Every object has a cultural implication and political stand in a way, but you can really do that with every single object.
The yogurt caps?
Yeah. Market, capitalism, consumption.
Crowds of people trying to save the Dan and yogurt cap.
you never know in the future. World might disappear, and then you have moments for everything nowadays. Check the internet. I'm sure there is a blog about the Yellow Cup
movement.
No, but I think, you know, that maybe it's not the whale itself who is saying save me or the implication.
No, but come on.
We put information in every object we use.
It's a public image in a way that many of your pieces aren't.
I don't think we have really, at least not in the work, and not in any of my work, there is a direct claim of some kind of ecological kind of, you know, it's not like a...
What about the Costa Rican rainforest?
What?
Well, I mean, come on, I mean...
What? I don't think I work politically like that. I think it's just my work is political. I think that it's very obvious that precisely the stepping in and relation with every object, every specificity in terms of the way I produce it or I deal with it has in consideration all the political or cultural implications of the thing I'm dealing with. It's not just about bones and graphite. It's not just about cardboard. It's not about plastic. It's not about aluminum or marble or whatever, plasticine. But I think that none of my objects is in itself a statement of... I don't have...
Well, it's not an answer, but maybe it's a way of asking a question.
How do you put it? It's not like...
Say it in Spanish. They all speak Spanish.
It's not a... I don't think it's a demonstration. It's not a political demonstration in that sense. It's not a propaganda. It's different. It's a way of showing the political aspect of an object without... screaming, that is political. So I think, for example, we don't have in Mexico, although we have this sanctuary and we have so much coast in the ocean, this is the first whale, the first skeleton of a whale that is properly assembled. That is the first time that a whale, that's why all these photos that you saw, these are all the photographs were taken by Marco, and he was at the same time taking photographs of ourselves working, and you see the drawing and all that, but also he was cataloging photographically every bone, so to have the scientific, testimony, documentation of the thing. So some of those photos that they look very nice, actually, a long time I don't see them, that you can see the detail of every drawing in the bone is, in fact, trying to capture every bone as a scientist. So he has every single bone registered. So I think that Marco was very aware of that. We were aware of that. At the end, the country, after looking at this, realized that there is no other whale in a country that has so much ocean and a sanctuary. So, still, is in itself political, and I think it's interesting, but it's not the reason why we did this. I mean, it's one of the many reasons.
So should we ask about the science? I mean, what does this give science, this whale?
Well, we're trying to find some book about the whale, and we only found one in the New York City of the Natural History Museum from 1909.
Really?
It's the only catalog that that we have of a complete skeleton of a gray whale. So no one in Mexico have this of a Mexican whale, because it's very difficult to say that, but
well,
it's
we need
true.
To know.
Well,
we need to know. Right?
Yeah. So the scientific guys had said to us, "You have this body. We can. You have the skeleton. You can organize this catalog because it's very important for us to know better the body of the skeleton of a whale."
And does the drawing interfere with knowledge or not?
We took a lot of photographs without...
Before the drawing.
Before, and yes, and after. And
no, well, the idea is the drawing helps you to see the structure, Molly.
Yeah.
That's the idea. So it's a technical drawing.
I
think... it tries to be a technical drawing. You know, it's obvious that the challenge in a piece like this is that the drawing doesn't look ornamental, doesn't look like a tattoo, or doesn't look like... decoration. I think that the black kites is a different thing. You have obviously a kind of conflict of two structures, but they grow together, and you are looking at maybe a thinking object. when you see black kites, but when you see the whale, you are looking at a string of movements. It's like, obviously, it's not like the whale is thinking or something. But somebody's thinking about the whale and then trying to, through the drawing, to express and to understand the reason of that structure. That's why the grid is for. I mean, so it's like having a kind of screen that you can measure something behind the screen or something. So the drawing as a kind of grid that helps you measure or helps you perceive better the anatomy of the skeleton. So
let's take some questions from the audience since we're running out of time.
Well, they might want to leave now.
Well, if they want to leave, they can leave. There's somebody over here. The center, if you can just please wait for the mic to come to you so we can hear you.
Hello. I guess at first I was, I'm torn because as a scientist and artist, there's part of me that screams that you drew on the actual whale itself. But I just wanted you to speak on just the difference between a scientist and an artist, and that you can go to the Museum of Natural History and find art inside of there, and then also just in an odd way that you're actually working on behalf of the scientists and giving this whale more of a life than it would be if it were in a natural history museum. I don't know.
Well, it's in a library. I think that is very important what you say. For me, it was important that this is a commission, not so much in terms of, let's say, governmental building that is the power. It's not about the power of the states so much. I mean, you can claim that the library has implications, but somehow the library and that project as a library, perhaps utopically, but was a project that interests me, that was interesting to me because it was like making some piece of art that has to do with knowledge, not so much in the context either of the art or either of the commemoration of some kind of political history. So I think that the library itself as a building, because I have to say I don't do commissions normally. This is an exception, and the exception was because the whole project was, and I say perhaps utopically, but was more into generating a space for knowledge. So it's not a church, it's not a government, it's not a government building, it's not a capitalist art fair of kind of world fair of business or something. It's a library. And I think that the whale, in its mythology, in the, there were many reasons why I thought that was even better than in a Museum of Natural History to show it in a place that is such as unnatural as a library, which all the fantasy and all the unreality of man is there. So it's like it's kind of a, you know, if you think in Borges, it's just the perfect labyrinth. And that I thought was interesting, to try such an specimen also that is not real. At the end, after the drawing is made, it became something different, you know, so.
Another question, yes.
You talked about your sculptures in both space and time. And it seems to me as though many of your sculptures are clearly related to space. Could you talk some about how you were viewing the whale as a sculpture in time as you were completing the project?
Yeah, just the whale, or may I talk about some other ones more easy?
We're here for the whale.
We are here for the whale, right?
We are here for the whale.
That's not my idea. I never thought about it. Well, I think it's probably very simplistic. There are many ways to deal with this. It's very hard to talk about time. Definitely, it's very hard. If we think in cycles, if we think that there are many ways to graphically express time or to try to describe sequence of repetitions, or maybe we have in our memory this image of the water when you drop a stone in the rings. Maybe we have in our body the information of an expanding universe, and that expanding universe somehow is time itself. Maybe we are time. And maybe the anatomy and the way skeletons are built has to do with time, because they are made for movement and displacement. Perhaps that is a way of, in a way of a kind of diagram of time. So trying to, it's like when you see, I don't know, like a graphic of the spaceship traveling in the space, or the astronauts scheduled, or when you see a list of things you have to do. In there are many ways, and I'm interested in the ways that how graphic, that how we can express time graphically. On the other hand, in a tridimensional object, you have already time because you have to walk around. It's not like a static thing. To really fully appreciate a sculpture, you have to see it. You have to walk around. I think I have few objects that they are, I think, successfully talking about that time of relation. That means the moment that you are confronted with an object that you have to make time, and the object itself transforms in time when you are walking around or you think how it was made. And I think this yielding stone, the idea that will never hardens, has always been changing. When you roll it, it's changing, and the accumulation of time is what makes the shape of this piece. Perhaps La Dehes, the Citroën, when it's coated and reassembled, you can feel the movement of this machine moving in time, displacement. The perspective is transformed. You can see perspective without movement, but that is a very funny trick in terms of time. Bicycles, there is always one direction. This idea of perpetual motion. I think the idea of perpetual motion has been important for many sculptures. I think a lot of the art in the 20th century tried to deal with this idea of making an object that moves constantly. And you have, you know, op art, kinetic art. You have many schools, many ways that art and sculpture is trying to express time. So, you know, for me too, and yogurt cups also, when you enter the room, there is always one missing because you cannot see the four at the same time. You enter into a tri-dimensional space and you are right in the center. You are that center. And that the movement of between the four dots, you know that always one is missing. That is generating a sense of time. So I think it's, you know, I don't know. I wish I could answer better.
Yeah, over here. Hi. Hi. When I look at your mobile matrix, I see a perfect grid stretched over something that's predictable, stretched over an organic object that's unpredictable. So I heard you earlier speak about this relationship when these two meet, there's a collapse. And I didn't hear, I know this is about the mobile matrix exclusively, but I when I think of the mobile matrix, I obviously think of Black Heights, but I also think of your chessboard, Horses Running Wild, and I think of a sort of ideal, perfect, predictable system, not clashing, but collapsing with some kind of sense of unpredictability. And I didn't know if you've also felt that connection too when thinking about the works.
Yes, but that is very 90s. And it's horses running endlessly, no horses running wild.
Oh, so excuse me.
That will be a different piece. Yeah, definitely. it reminds me like Chaos Theory and all that, and in the 90s was amazing. Yeah, I know, I enjoyed it. I have a lot of books with fractals and stuff. I haven't opened them in a long time. Yeah, definitely. I think that the idea of that, generating a system, as you say, or something like a kind of game or a kind of a structure that then you can just let it go somehow, and that the implications of the results are unpredictable but constant. So you know that it's going to happen. It's just that you don't know what is going to happen. I think it's a nice, it has to do with chance, and my relationship, the love with John Cage, how much it has been important to me, the way he writes, the way he thinks. So I think that the idea of generating a system that expresses chaos or expresses the unpredictable, but it's constant. So there is a structure that you can somehow generate that happens in life, that is the surprise, that is something you are not controlling. Somehow, the idea of disappointment has to do with that in my work, the idea that try to clean the preconceptions of the spectator, and of course starting with me, trying to erase preconceptions so I can have a relationship with whatever is happening that is ready to see what is happening. And is where it, and that somehow is trying to accept unpredictability. But to accept and to provoke the unpredictable, you need some discipline and some structure. I like also the idea of Satori in Zen culture, the idea that you have something to wake up. Maybe the shoebox in this show tries to do that. Like you have the entrance and suddenly you see that and it's like kind of uncomfortable, arbitrary, absurd. And then you go on next, you see four spitting drawings, which makes sense, of course. And then four yogurt cups that... Anyway, so it's a way of generating a situation of unpredictability. That's why I probably like games too, and in the work, like the billiard table with the pendulum is adding a new element of chance with the ball floating around. Is you add time now, because when you have to hit the three balls, one of the balls is moving all the time. It's not just that you have to hit one and two, but you have to hit one and then two is moving. So you have to hit one and two, but the two has to be in point A or B or C. So that is generating a lot more of prediction. So, but it's always possible to predict at the end. I don't know. So,
we'll take a last question and any other comments that any of you may have.
You can think of. I don't think they want to leave, huh?
You want to say one last?
Hi. I just had one question.
This does.
Can you?
Go ahead.
A question about. If you saw any relationship between the Scarpa Terrace project and the whale, because I was thinking about the idea of retrieval, of casting one form from another, and the fact that you'd done it with an element of architecture, and whether that in any way laid, you know, a memory or an impulse for the whale. I mean, it might be a stretch, but it was just something that I was thinking about. And the idea that you were talking about making something that was very specific with the whale, and then how it took on life as it traveled, the idea of something that you never imagined would travel, but then in the same way that the Scarpa Terrace traveled to what that became when it went to Madrid, for example. And if you could talk about that, if it has any meaning.
Well, just for the ones who maybe don't know this work, I did this replica of of a piece of architecture in the Italian pavilion that is permanently there. It was built in 1956 by Scarpa, and it's a pergola kind of thing between two patios, between two rooms, through a patio. So I was abandoned for a very long time, and right the space next to it, I chose that space because I wanted to build a replica of that inside, but in wood. One-to-one, so it became a kind of model, life-size model of this pergola in the Italian pavilion. So I built for traveling after. So I built it in a way that I could disassemble that and take it outside and then becoming a kind of a sculpture. I think it's interesting. I don't want to go, because it can be into a very extensive consideration. It's just that I guess in the last 5 years, 7 years, a lot of my work has taken place outside somehow the gallery or museum. When I did the whale, or I did the even the Scarpa Pavilion is in a museum, but it's outside. It's talking about the architecture outside the house. So I think that try to bring things from the outside to the inside space. In theory, the Platonic space of the museum has been always something that interests me. I think the way to question this Platonic space is to bring things from the outside, but they cannot just be like ready-mades, I think. They have to be, it's not such a thing in a way as a ready-made, just like that. At this time, at this age we have in terms of art, there are so many things around that to say just a ready-made, I think it doesn't make so much sense. So when I take this piece of a sculpture and I make a replica, sorry, this piece of architecture, I made a replica and then make it travel, I think it's generating an illusion of many things, architecture, sculpture, space, time. I think that, yeah, there is this connection, but on the other hand, I mean, it's, you know, in terms of public sculpture, I don't know what it's going to take me to. It's just like, there are all these displayments. It's like if I was playing a big chess game around the world or something with myself. It's like I move this and then I said, like, it's like a sculpture running endlessly, I will call my work lately. Not wild, huh?
I have one last question, yes, actually. Gabriel, in the 90s,
wow,
everybody said...
Long gone.
No, but you had this rep as a great traveler, professional traveler, nomad. They, you know, every question, in every interview had this question about traveling. I don't know how those interviews go now, whether you're still answering the traveling question, but I think I would like to know, as you reflect now about traveling, what the role of traveling is for your work, is for part of your process. Because you still travel.
Well,
but differently, right?
I don't know. I there was something I never truly, or I didn't want to answer, and I was not convinced. There were two things that they told I was. No, one is nomad, mm-hmm. I never like it. And the other was poet, and I never like it either. I don't like both. I think they're like primitivizing a little bit. Like, yo, you are such a poet. It's like, well, I know how to drill. I know how to do other things. No? It's like the poet is a little bit like too romantic, and then the
I never did it.
The nomad
on the record.
Hello? No, what is that? The nomad and the poet. I never fully. Yeah, it's time to go. I'm sure, right? No, it's not me. Well, anyway, they are two. I think I always travel a little bit. Yeah, it's me, maybe. Sorry, for this is the last one. So, yeah, the nomadic, I think it was a way, too easy way to describe somebody that was displaced or somebody that was an outsider, somebody that has a nationality, but maybe was not the right thing to say that this guy was Mexican or something. And there was something that was just in the air also. I know for many artists, not just me.
Well, it was Deleuze, too, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know who's that, but anyway.
No, I think so. But
anyway,
now,
no, I know. Was the subject of the 90s. Yeah. I don't know what to say today about that. I think there are many things, even site-specificity, I guess, multiculturalism or... The idea of the poetic. For example, there is some misunderstanding. Like, I always did big projects also. I like, for me, and you mentioned it today, like the human scale in the work. I try to, and there is always there the human scale, but that doesn't mean that it's always into the intimacy or the small. I think that you can also talk about human scale in relation with a whale or the sinking wheel, fortune wheel. When I do some big projects, even La Dez, the mechanical or very cold gesture doing La Dez has to do with the body. I don't know. I will call that poetic object, and I don't think that nomad express what I am. I still travel. I still don't like to be called a poet or anything like that. And I think it's just trying to get good ideas and try to discover other things that's why I'm curious about going somewhere else. But sometimes traveling is distracting, and I think in a way I'm very sedentary. I have been always, all my life, very sedentary in a way. So I think there is something, the mythology of the traveler is overrated, I think. And I don't know, I mean, it's hard for me. It's like saying what, if you are still Mexican or not, or something like that. It's very funny. No, it's not something I'm really like...
It's related to the question of the outside, I think.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't go so much outside to the street anymore. That is true. I think it's true. I mean, there is something about going out, in and out. I think there are times that you are spending more times indoors, and sometimes you are more into the fresh air. Black Kites is done indoors, definitely. And the Matrix Mobile is done outdoors. We travel far away to get that skeleton done. And as you could see in the photographs, it was done in an old train station, abandoned. So I think still I travel, just to catch some whale around.
All right. Very good.
Let's go fish.
Gabriel, Moline, Marco, I think that's it, right? Anything else?
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.